The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case is 10-2198, State of Ohio versus Calvin McKelton. For the appellant, Ms. Prude Smithers.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. The trial of Calvin McKelton was, simply put, unconstitutional. There were problems throughout McKelton's trial, and so many problems that it was very hard for me to figure out what to come and which of the issues, the many issues that we raised, to argue before this court. There was a breakdown on the part of the defense counsel, the trial court, and the prosecutor that resulted in a conviction and sentence that cannot pass constitutional scrutiny.
Counsel, would you speak into the microphone?
Oh, sorry. And McKelton's case must be reversed. The combination of errors in McKelton's case that I want to discuss include a trial judge who early on set an October 4th trial date and wanted to continue with that trial date no matter the consequences. A trial judge who continuously allowed the admission of improper hearsay and other acts evidence. Trial attorneys who were not prepared to go to trial and whose hands were tied by an overreaching prosecutor who abused his discretion by ensuring that the defense could not adequately be prepared for trial. These problems resulted in errors that interfered with McKelton's right to defend against the case against him. It caused his attorneys to be ineffective, both by their own failures and by being forced to be ineffective, and significantly, the errors resulted in unfair trial and sentencing proceedings. And in reviewing this record, I want to kind of talk about, I don't mean to try to bounce back and forth through issues, but I want to kind of start at the beginning and go through some of the problems that were set out from the beginning.
Well, let me take you to the end.
Okay.
Was he innocent?
Was he innocent?
Yes, and of which crimes? Was there just a failure of proof?
I think that there was a failure of proof here. If you look at our sufficiency of the evidence and manifest weight of the evidence issues, and you look at you review the evidence in its totality, you'll see that there was no DNA evidence linking Mr. McKelton to this to Margaret Allen's murder. When you look at Jermaine Evans' murder, there was nothing also tying him to that murder. The testimony presented was that Jermaine Evans was a drug dealer who regularly robbed people. He wore a bulletproof vest on a regular basis. He carried a gun with him. This because he was in danger of being shot. And there's no evidence that directly links McKelton.
When you say no evidence, you say that there's no physical DNA evidence.
There's no physical DNA evidence.
Okay, and but then there was other evidence that was presented in the form of statements by your client to others, correct?
Yes, there was. There were many witnesses, many jailhouse informants who came in and testified about the fact that Calvin told them that he committed the crime.
Is this a circumstantial evidence case in your view?
It is it's highly circumstantial. I don't think there's any direct evidence linking McKelton to this crime. It's highly circumstantial.
So we can base a conviction on circumstantial evidence, can we not?
That is accurate, but I think that you have to review the evidence here skeptically because a number of the significant witnesses in this case were jailhouse informants.
Well, actually, the credibility of those witnesses would be a determining factor for the finders of fact, the jury, and they've already resolved that.
Well, I don't think that they were able to resolve it accurately, though, because when you look at the testimony of those informants, the trial court significantly limited the cross-examination of those informants.
You want us to reweigh the credibility of the jailhouse? There were three that testified as to what your client said in connection with the killing, right?
Yes.
And you want us to reweigh their testimony? Is that what you're, are you asking us to reweigh their testimony or the credibility of their testimony?
No, I'm asking you to look at the, review this trial in its totality, find that there was just a, such a breakdown on so many levels, so much hearsay and improper prejudicial evidence was admitted both through the testimony and through defense counsel's eliciting some testimony, and then the trial court's improperly limiting the cross-examination of some of these witnesses. And that is essentially important when you're dealing with jailhouse informants because they are highly suspect. You need to know whether there's bias there, whether they're looking for favor, and I don't think if you review the trial record, the trial judge here was not able to fully...
So specify for me what you mean by limitation on cross of the jailhouse witnesses.
Pardon?
Can you specify for me what you mean by the limitation of cross-examination of the jailhouse witnesses?
Well, if you look at the testimony of, I think it was Marcus Sneed, Lemuel Johnson, Charles Bryant, there was attempts by defense counsel to talk about the convictions that they were facing at the time, to talk about the potential sentences that they were facing at the time, and to talk about the fact that their trials had been continued until after they testified in McCountain's case. Clearly, the defense counsel is trying to show that there's bias, and each time he's asking these questions, there are objections that are being sustained by the trial court.
Counsel, with respect to Margaret Allen, the testimony, at least, of these jailhouse snitches would lead a jury to convict, but would not get him death, right?
You're talking about Margaret Allen?
Yes.
Yes, because he was charged with murder in that case.
Right.
Not aggravated murder.
Okay. So, and would it be fair to say that with respect to Evans, the facts are less clear as to what happened?
Yes. I'm
the facts that were presented to the trial court.
Right, yes. I agree
and
with that.
Did, in fact, the prosecution have different theories about what happened to Evans?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the bill of particulars and kind of the theory of the case from the beginning, it was that McKelton actually physically was there and killed Jermaine Evans. And you see great pains to try to cross-examine Crystal Evans, who is McKelton's alibi witness, to change her story. You not only see that, but you have the admission of her phone conversations with Detective Luke.
So what did they argue in closing? How did Evans die? At whose hand?
Well, towards the end of the proceedings, right when they were going to start thinking about the jury instructions, the court said, well, I think the court suggested at that point that a complicity instruction be given. And at that point, the defense, or not the defense, but the state argued that Calvin actually wasn't there, that he had Jermaine killed.
So at the start of the trial, they're arguing he killed him, and at the end of the trial,
they're arguing that he had him killed.
He had somebody else do it.
Yeah, and so you have, and this is just one of the instances where they're interfering with McKelton's right to prepare a defense.
Well, wait a minute, was there evidence produced at trial that fleshed out that closing argument opinion put forth that it was a murder for hire?
I don't believe there was any evidence that was presented. I think that what happened was Crystal Evans was McKelton's alibi witness. They could not get her to change her story. They tried, they had her on the stand for a long time trying to get her to change her story.
I understand that, but my question to you is what evidence was presented that would suggest that McKelton had Evans killed?
I cannot think of any direct evidence that he actually had him killed.
Circumstantial or direct. What evidence is there that he had Evans killed?
I don't believe that there was any that he had him killed, aside from the fact that they showed a motive for him wanting him killed because the police are, like, questioning him. But there's no evidence that they don't have anyone saying, you know, I heard that he had.
But they do have your client saying to death or to jailhouse companions, taking responsibility for Evan's death.
Yes, that was their testimony, and I think that you have to, once again, they're jailhouse informants, you have to look at their credibility, and I think
I'm asking is for the evidence that would switch it from McKelton actually pulling the trigger to McKelton instructing or hiring someone to pull the trigger. That's a big leap for the prosecution, for the state to make without, and you're saying there's not one iota of evidence that was presented at trial that would have supported that declaration to the jury.
I mean, I guess that you could infer maybe from some of the jailhouse informants' testimony that when he's saying that he did the same thing to, I think there's some people who testified that he had to get rid of Mick. But there's none of them are saying he said, I had someone else do it. The only thing that I believe led them to change their theories was that they could not get Crystal, his alibi witness.
Was it presented to the jury as an alternative? Either Mr. McKelton did it himself or he hired somebody to do that, but he did take responsibility through the testimony of the jailhouse snitches that he's responsible for Mr. Evans's demise.
That's not how it was presented by the state. The state said at one point, we know that McKelton had someone else do it. I think that was inconsistent with what the evidence that they were presenting from the very beginning, the evidence that they...
Something that was presented that allowed for that jury to find that.
They did find it. I mean, there was a lot of prejudicial evidence admitted that went to the heart of the matter here that I could see the jury using and they're improperly using to reach the determination. There's all kinds of improper hearsay, evidence, and proper...
Are you saying there was improper hearsay that supported the theory that it was a murder for hire?
I cannot pinpoint the hearsay where they're even talking about it, where it's a murder for hire.
Okay.
These informants are saying that he said that he got rid of Mick. They're not saying that he hired someone. And I believe that the state changed their theory because they couldn't get a state witness to change their alibi.
Counsel, it seems that you're not really arguing the penalty phase to us, but you're arguing more of a cumulative error in the trial. Is that what I hear you saying?
Well, yeah, I'm definitely focusing on the trial phase and the wealth of errors in the trial phase, but I'd also point this court to the mitigation phase just because of the lack of advocacy that was demonstrated during that mitigation phase.
Could we go back to that? Because you started out by saying this trial was precipitous. In other words, the judge did not allow for an additional continuance. Mm-hmm. The one killing was in 2008. That was Allen. Then in 2009, we had Evans.
Mm-hmm.
He was indicted in February of 2010,
yes.
And the trial was October 2010, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
All right, and were there continuances requested by the defense?
Yes, and significantly, one of the last continuances was also a request to withdraw from by counsel, because what you see early on in this case is a notice from the state saying that they're not going to provide the names of certain witnesses in this case.
And that's because they were concerned about the safety of those witnesses.
That was what they asserted in their pleadings. And so on June 3rd, defense counsel objected to that, and at that point stated, I need to at least know whether I have a conflict of interest. I'm a defense attorney. I could represent one of your witnesses. Let me know if there's a conflict of interest. The defense counsel also several times requested that they have the documents marked for counsel only. The state objected to that. On June 3rd, July 21st, and August 6th, defense counsel asked about potential conflicts. And the state, in June, July, and almost all through August, ignored counsel's repeated request to figure out whether there was a conflict in this case, and objected to even providing the information for counsel only. So as late as August 6th, the state informed defense counsel that if he were counsel on representing one of the witnesses, the state would have known, the state would have let them know that by then. So then what you see at the end of August is the state finally saying, oh, you actually do have a conflict of interest. You're representing one of the witnesses who is testifying against McKelton.
Was this the lead counsel that we're talking about, or was it the second chair?
This was Richard Goldberg, who Mr. McKelton had worked with, retained early on in his case. Because this was a secret indictment, they did not realize when he was first retained that it was a capital indictment. And so the court appointed two Rule 20 attorneys to work alongside with Goldberg. Now Goldberg was a person, by all accounts, Goldberg was a person who had the relationship with McKelton, and he is also the person who dealt with him, met with him.
Counsel, I think what Justice Lansinger is asking you, though, is, was Mr. Goldberg lead counsel?
He was not lead under the Rule 20.
So the answer is no?
No. Under the Rule 20, he was, in effect, the lead. He was the person taking the lead in terms of meeting with Calvin, discussing the case with Calvin. But when they did the Rule 20 form, since he is not Rule 20 certified, he was not designated as lead.
Well, I guess that doesn't really answer the question for me then. At trial, mm-hmm. who was questioning the witnesses or who was presenting the witnesses? Was it to be Mr. Goldberg?
That was my understanding. And if you look at the motion for continuance and the motion for withdrawal, both Cook and Howard are trying to get off the case. And one of the reasons they want to get off the case is they say that we've lost an essential cog. This is the person who knows the case, and he's essential to this case. We can't proceed. We can't be effective in continuing to represent McKelton without having either new counsel appointed or a continuance.
Well, let me ask you about the representation. You're saying that Mr. Goldberg was privately retained by Mr. Kelton?
Yes, that's correct.
He was being paid by Mr. Kelton?
Yes.
And then he also had two attorneys appointed by the state to represent him?
That is correct.
So he wasn't indigent. How could he have two attorneys appointed for him?
Well, I am not certain about the circumstances leading up to the appointment, but I believe that he used the funds available that he had to retain Mr. Goldberg and then did not have any remaining funds, was my understanding.
Do you know how much he paid Mr. Goldberg?
I'm not aware of that. And when you look at reviewing the transcript of the motion to withdraw, there's some significant points that should be reviewed. From a defense counsel, there's an admission that there had been a breakdown in communication. They believe that part of the reason the state wants to fit in with the stun belt is because McKelton has made threats against them. They believe they cannot effectively and ethically continue to represent McKelton. Significantly, there's admission that they only secured an investigator, despite the fact that the trial court gave them funds for a psychological expert, a mitigation expert, and a forensic expert. And with that was an implied admission that back in March, when the trial court asked, are all of your experts hard at work, and defense counsel says yes, that was not true, because they did not hire all those experts. They had only hired an investigator.
Well, why do you think that they needed to hire those experts?
Because this is, I think under the ABA guidelines, it's fairly clear that for a capital case, you need to hire the necessary experts.
Those are guidelines, if applicable. They're not, Supreme Court said they're not written in stone that every case has to have all of these experts. I mean, the mitigation, as I read the case, was that, horrible upbringing, a mother who was a drug addict and a prostitute. At a very early age, your client became a a drug dealer with a heart of gold because he used his proceeds to provide for his siblings, and that was mitigation evidence. But there's no evidence about or statement about a low IQ or mental health issues.
Well, I believe that's true because I don't, you can only know those things if you actually conduct an investigation, and that's why it's essential in capital cases to obtain those experts. Whether or not you use them later on is another thing, but you need to conduct the investigation. You need to know what's there, and what you see in
if
mitigation.
If the client is not exhibiting any signs of mental health issues or low IQ, can assist in their defense, etc., you're stating that you still have to have an evaluation to see if they have a low IQ.
You at the very least need a mitigation expert, and yes, in my opinion, you need a psychological expert. You cannot tell psychological issues just by looking and talking to your client. That is for an expert to make that determination, and you need to have an expert evaluate to see those things. And that's why the judge is giving the funds. That's why the ABA guidelines say that it's necessary to get these experts. That's why the judge in this case said, I will give you the funds, and I won't limit the funds in this case, because that's what's necessary in a capital trial. What's also important from this hearing is that McKelton discloses that Cook and Howard have only met with him twice personally, and in the second meeting, they go in to a room with him with an officer present and ask him to take a plea for life without parole. This is his second private meeting with these attorneys. And this is where you see the error in the court's ruling, because the trial court ignored all this and instead makes the focus on McKelton being a problem. He has evidence that defense counsel has not been investigating the case. He has evidence that there's been a complete breakdown between the attorney-client relationship. And so that determination by the trial court was wrong. And going from that, kind of going back to what I talked about initially, which was the non-disclosure, I think that when you look at this case and see what the state did in this case, not disclosing 8 witnesses the night before the trial, that is an egregious violation of constitutional rights in this case. There was no way that trial counsel could be prepared given these facts. There were 36 witnesses presented. 8 of those witnesses were not provided to defense counsel.
Counsel,
until
let me make sure I understand the reasoning for the subsequent motions. The 2 appointed counsel, mm-hmm. was it their understanding, or did they represent to the court that they were there for sentencing only?
I don't know if they ever represented that they were there for sentencing only. They did represent, at some point there was a representation that Goldberg was taking on the large amount of work, the client, dealing with the client, that kind of stuff, and that they were more of the death penalty motions type people to be utilized on the case, since they did have the Rule 20 certification. So going back, they have no idea about the names of 8 of these witnesses until 5:12, the night before trial starts.
And what did those witnesses testify to?
These witnesses were some of the most provided some of the most damaging. Those were the 4 jailhouse informants. Mm-hmm. There was also 2 of Margaret Allen's friends, 1 of Jermaine Evans' friends who testified.
The jailhouse informants, were they still in jail at the time of the trial?
Yes, they were still in jail.
And leading up to it?
Yes.
And their names were not disclosed because there was fear that they would be harmed?
Well, that was the state's assertion, yes.
So the state felt that they were not secure in the penal facilities?
That was, I mean, they never really specifically, and that's another problem with the non-disclosure hearing and with the non-disclosure notices, they never really specify why these specific witnesses are in danger. They talk about generally Calvin McKelton being a problem, but they don't specify why these particular witnesses might be in danger. I think that's a problem here because...
Were all eight of them incarcerated?
No, four of them were incarcerated.
Right. Who were the other four then?
The other four was a friend of Jermaine Evans, two friends of Margaret Allen's. Actually, one of the people who were on the non-disclosed list ended up not testifying. So four were incarcerated and three were not. And if you look at the testimony that this witness was provided, they provided testimony that the defendant was previously convicted of a witness intimidation charge, that he offered to kill a witness for them, that he had offered to kill other witnesses in the past. They offered testimony regarding the ultimate issue before the jury, whether a defendant killed Margaret Allen and Jermaine Evans. They provided prejudicial hearsay testimony from Margaret Allen regarding the fact that the defendant would kill her if he saw her with another man.
One of the witnesses testified that McKelton was offering to become a hitman for him.
Yes.
He had a drug business, and he was under federal indictment?
I believe so. I think he had had state charges, and they moved him to the federal court.
Then they moved him over to the federal system, and he was getting ready to deal on the federal side, and then he said, I've got this information about McKelton.
Yeah.
Okay, well, McKelton is in jail pending a capital murder case, correct?
Yes.
And he's negotiating becoming a hitman with this witness. When did he think he was going to have time to become a hitman? I mean, to me, the testimony is a little incredible, I guess.
It is very incredible. It's incredible on a number of levels because on one side, the state is painting McKelton as this person who will not let a witness live. If there is a witness who knows something bad that he does, he's going to take care of that. But on the other hand, they have McKelton telling anyone who gets in the car with him, I killed Margaret Allen. I got rid of Jermaine Evans. So he's creating witnesses, more witnesses, and, you know, under the state's theory, every day. And that's just inconsistent with who they say they are. He is. They're saying that he's a person who just won't let a witnesses live. That's the stand he takes. He will not let a witness if there's someone out there. But yet he's telling people who he doesn't even know that well, according to this
testimony.
But
allegedly, Mr. Evans was present when he choked Margaret Allen. So this isn't just hearsay or, you know, like with Mrs. Evans, where he breaks down in a drunken state and confesses to having killed Margaret Allen. This is a different situation. Evans witnessed the actual killing. He was present in the home.
That was the testimony, I believe, of his mother, and there might have been another witness who might have testified to that.
Right.
But, yeah.
How many days after the disclosure of the witnesses did they testify?
Some testified as soon as the next day. I don't have exactly when the trial took place over that next week. So some testified that day, but not everyone was exactly that day, some a few days later.
When they were disclosed, the fact that they had pending charges and may have negotiated a reduction in their charges in return for testimony, was that disclosed at the time their names are disclosed, or does that not come out till...
I believe their names and their prior convictions were the things that were disclosed.
Their pending charges?
The pending charges, I believe, were included in that also. But what you could have, this is like some of the most important investigation that is needed in a capital case, is when you have informants like this who may lack credibility. Gerald Wilson got up on the stand and changed his testimony. Had they had the ability to talk to him before, had they known his name before, they could have known that he was going to change his his statement from what he gave to the police. They could have known about his assertion that Quincy Jones, one of the fellow inmates, was going around the prison trying to get people to testify against McKelton. They could have investigated those things. But the fact that it wasn't disclosed until the last minute prevented them from being able to do that.
You're well into your rebuttal time.
Okay, I will sit down then.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Oster.
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court, Michael Oster and my colleague, Lena Alcom Howie, on behalf of the state of Ohio, we would anticipate splitting this argument, especially given the fact that so many different issues have now been touched upon out of the 22 that were raised here. I'd like to begin, though, where it was left off in the Criminal Rule 16 hearing and what was provided. First, I'd like to make sure it's very clear. Criminal Rule 16, its wording and its staff notes were followed perfectly in this case. There was absolutely no item that was not followed that Criminal Rule 16 dictated. As to, I think it was Justice O'Donnell, your question, when you look at these witnesses, and there was eight non-disclosed, seven of the eight did not testify. When you look at how many days or how many nights had passed that the defense counsel knew of who these witnesses were, witness number 61, Shonda Luther, was the next day. She was the very last witness on October 5th, which was the first day of testimony, but it was the second day of actual trial. After that, Shara Mam is the two nights. Charles Bryant is after three nights, as is Andre Ridley. Then you start in to get into Neil Johnson, Marcus Sneed, and Gerald Wilson, the so-called jailhouse informants. They were not till the next week of trial.
Counsel, if you'd slow down for me, please.
I'm sorry, there's so much to cover. I apologize.
I understand. You have plenty of time. You started out by saying there were eight witnesses, seven of whom did not testify?
One of the eight, so seven did testify.
Seven did. Okay.
Sorry, I apologize.
You. Okay.
I'll slow down. There's
Thank
just
you.
A lot to try to
Thank
get through,
you.
Your Honor. So when you look at these witnesses, these seven now, that did testify, only one of which was that next day, and she was the very last witness that day. When you look at who they've just, during oral argument, called the critical three, the jailhouse informants, they didn't testify until Gerald Wilson was 10-11, so the next Monday. Lemuel Johnson was 10-12, and Marcus Sneed was 10-11. So you're looking.
Let's talk for a minute, if we can, about the one that testified the very next day. Is it your position that you could conceal the identity of that witness right up until she took the stand?
No, Your Honor.
What's the reasonable standard here?
Criminal Rule 16, I believe F, clearly dictates that these names must be given over at the beginning of trial. All parties here in this case seem to agree that the beginning of trial is after voir dire, when the jury is sworn in, so the jeopardy has attached. And that was exactly when these names were given over, was immediately preceding the jury being sworn in that first night on October 4th. And so the rule itself dictates when the last time these can be given over, and it is the commencement of trial under Criminal Rule 16.
What was the theory of the state for not doing it earlier when it was asked?
Not doing it earlier was in the protection of these witnesses.
Okay, so what was the theory of why they were in danger? How were they going to be endangered?
Well, I think if you look at specifically Criminal Rule 16D, it gives what may be considered reasonable or articulable grounds by the state of Ohio. And in there, almost everyone that they are given, you have in this case. First, let's look at the nature of the charge itself. Mr. McKelton has a capital indictment for the execution of a victim witness. That clearly is the nature of this case.
Which he did, I mean, it's alleged he did it himself.
If you look, and this kind of dovetails, so before I go too far into that, but if you do look at Michael Nix's testimony, Michael Nix says that he and about three, Jermaine and two other gentlemen, leave in this white panel van. The theory is they're going to hit a lick somewhere, and it is after that that Jermaine's not found. So Jermaine is not seen solely with just the appellant at that time. I think that's some of that testimony that gives credence to the possibility of someone else potentially being the trigger man in this case. But yes, that is what he is charged with here in this case, the nature of the case. But also, if you look at his past criminal history, which the past history is another reasonable articulable ground in Criminal Rule 16D.
Well, where were these at least the folks who were identified as jailhouse snitches, where were they leading up to the trial? Were they out on the streets or were they locked up?
No, they were locked up.
Okay.
But
and where were they locked up?
I believe two were in the possession of the state of Ohio at one level or another, and another one was in federal custody.
Were any of them in the same facility that McKelton was in?
No. But when you look...
So he was going... He was a threat to them that he would get them harmed in state and federal prison facilities.
Potentially, but also these witnesses, and at the Criminal Rule 16 hearing, the state specifically said, in regards to witness 62, 68, and 69, and this is on page 28 of that hearing in front of Judge Nastoff, that they are incarcerated, but they express a fear for their relatives who live in the same neighborhood that the appellant is from. Now, what else do we know about this appellant? Well, from jail, Michael Nix is subject to a drive-by shooting the day after his name is disclosed. That is stated to Judge Nastoff at this hearing. So is the appellant able to get word out that these things are happening? Michael Nix would probably, and didn't testify because he was so afraid after being subject to a drive-by shooting 20 minutes after someone at a birthday party asked him how Mr. McKelton's trial was going.
Okay, well, let me jump you to the end of the trial. You start out, the trial starts out, the death spec is relating to the death of Evans, a witness, to the death of Margaret Allen, right?
Correct.
And in opening, the prosecutors, did you try the case?
No, sir, I did not. I am in the trial record on some of the motions, okay, but I did not do the trial.
In the opening introduction, in the opening statements, the prosecution is alleging that McKelton killed Allen and killed Evans as well. Is that right?
Correct.
That he did it.
I believe that's how their opening statement.
And what position did the prosecution take in closing argument with respect to the death of Evans?
My recollection of the closing argument is more of a either he was the trigger man or had one of these other individuals do it. I did not read the closing quite as strictly as has been talked about today. I read it that there was almost a dual theory in closing argument.
So...
either way being proper.
Okay, so let me take you now to the end. He gets death, and we're here in the Supreme Court, and we have to do our own evaluation whether he should get death or not.
Correct.
Back a number of years ago, I think I'm the only member of this panel that was involved in a discussion of residual doubt. And the court decided we're not going to entertain residual doubt. I dissented. Wouldn't this be a perfect case to say no to death because of residual doubt when the prosecution can't even agree as to how it is that the murder occurred that gets him to the death penalty? And wouldn't that be the cleanest, neatest and most just way to end all of this, instead of arguing about, well, should we have a new trial? Those kinds of things. Just say he doesn't get death because there's residual doubt. End of case. Spend the rest of your life in prison.
Well,
it wouldn't be a bad outcome, would it?
I don't think it's a just outcome to how the evidence played out at trial. I don't think it's a just outcome to giving credence to this court's decision, which, in all due respect, although you dissented, you had to dissent because this court's
right.
Residual doubt isn't...
We can change.
You can, although the jury should have been instructed upon that as well to consider that. And I don't think that there's residual doubt that Mr. McKelton had Jermaine Evans killed to keep him from testifying about the strangulation
so
death of Margaret Allen.
So now you're convinced he had him killed rather than that he killed him?
He leaves. Michael Nix's testimony is that he leaves with Jermaine, Brian Adams, and Lamar Mouse Simmons, who were present. They all left in a white panel van. The theory of the state was that they were going out, and it was somewhat of a con to get Jermaine to go because they were going to go hit a lick. Well, Jermaine was the lick that was going to get hit. The exact trigger man when these things are done in the cover of night.
Hit a lick is a term that I'm not familiar with up in farm country. Explain it to me.
Hit a lick, is that what you said?
Yes.
Hit a lick typically either describes conducting some form of aggravated robbery or murder to go and do that kind of crime. It's a loose term, but is used.
A range of criminal activity.
A range, but not the broad scope of the ORC. It's typically meant to do some form of a violent crime, a lot of times either robbery or murder. And so I think when you look at the testimony of Lemuel Johnson, Marcus Sneed, when they say that Mr. Evans tells them, because Jermaine is the sole witness to what he did to Margaret Allen, I've got to get to him before the police get to him. And when they say, well, what does that mean, get to him? He explains to Marcus Sneed, get to him means kill him.
Well, your theory was he was more than a witness.
Correct. He participated in trying to cover up the scene, trying to make it look like a robbery gone bad. He participated in the gross abuse of the corpse in all levels of that. And he was the sole person who did participate and help, which is why Mr. McKelton's words to these individuals that he had to get rid of him. And when they asked, murder is specifically stated. There's no residual doubt there in all due respect, Justice. When you have that kind of testimony, and the jury clearly accepted that testimony when being able to observe the witnesses, look them in the eye, and hear about the good, the bad, and the ugly of those witnesses. Because while the appellant here has tried to say that these witnesses were limited by Judge Sage in what they were able to go over, I really think that when you look at these situations, and I don't want to read anything too fast, but in this case, these witnesses, a lot of their information about their prior charges, about what they were facing, about if they've taken a plea, if they haven't taken a plea. I mean, Marcus Sneed appeared in shackles in the court. And specifically, if you'll indulge me for a second, they were able to cross-examine Charles Bryant, that he was incarcerated, that he had discussed the case with Cincinnati Homicide, that he had a felonious assault conviction, that his case had been continued, that his attorney had advised him that his testimony might help out, that he currently had a felonious assault and other charges pending. Lemuel Johnson, they were able to cross-examine him about his current incarceration, his plea deal, that he's awaiting sentence, that his current what his current charge is, that he had discussions with the detectives about the case, that he had never told...
Which witness said that McKelton had Evans killed as opposed to killed him?
When you look at the testimony, Lemuel Johnson was the one who did the testimony of he had to get to Mick, and to get to Mick, he asked him to explain that an appellant meant he had to kill Evans. That's the transcript testimony on page 1748 to 1749, that he had to kill Evans.
Okay, that's McKelton killed Evans.
That's, according to Lemuel Johnson, that's the way it was explained.
So which witness suggested that he had him killed?
I believe that was through the testimony, or what was admitted, because Michael Nix was afraid to testify, but what was admitted through Michael Nix in that scenario is really where that plays out, is in Michael Nix's
counsel
testimony.
I guess that's, again, I'm being confused this morning.
I'm sorry?
That seems to be the same question the chief asked about 10 minutes ago, and Justice Pfeiffer's asking it now. Is there any testimony that we can look at that he had anyone killed, had them killed?
I think there was a multitude of testimony, and this plays out.
Well, if there's a multitude, then just choose one.
Well, I to be honest with you, Your Honor, this wasn't something that was, I think, fully briefed. Our theory in our brief was that he himself was the one who committed the murder. There is testimony, though, that this is kind of Calvin's M.O. I think that comes out through a number of different witnesses, that he isn't always the trigger man throughout these situations, that part of his M.O. is to have other people do these crimes for him. And I think that came out through the multitude of Sneed, Johnson, Michael Nix's testimony, Gerald Wilson. And I think when you look at some of these things, you know, Gerald Wilson, when he testifies about hearing about Margaret Allen being choked out and the front seat driver, one of appellant's confidants, Michael Howe, says, well, you can't say that in front of this guy. And according to Wilson, the response from appellant was, that's okay, he won't say anything or he'll end up like Mick. You know, Mr. McKelton in this case, and what's shown is his intimidation of witnesses, the way that he does his business, his drug business is, and I think there's testimony that Margaret Allen called him robber boy because he was known to rob other drug dealers, and it was known that Mr. McKelton, you did not cross Mr. McKelton.
Mick Evans himself, was he involved in the drug trade?
I believe so. You said Jermaine Evans? Or Mick or is his Mick. Nickname?
Yeah.
Mick. I believe he was, yeah.
So this case is really, the prosecutor built the case on circumstantial evidence, each piece leading to an inference for the jury. At least that's what you argued at trial.
Correct.
Correct. You don't have any direct testimony by someone saying this is what happened or this is what he did, but what you're saying based on all of the witnesses together, piece by piece, the circumstantial case was built.
Correct, and there's really the three building blocks. There's the testimony of the jailhouse informants of what Mr. Appellant has said to them. There's the motive block with Jermaine Evans being the only person and other testimony that he was the only witness and helper in the Margaret Allen murder. And then there's the consciousness of guilt evidence that was presented as well. And so those are really the three building blocks that a multitude of things go inside each of those that the jury was given. And when they came out with their decision beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. McKelton had
counsel, if I may, I'd like to talk about one of your building blocks as well. You keep referring to the witnesses as jailhouse informants. I'm uncomfortable with that phrase in the sense that, for example, at least as to Mr. Sneed, he wasn't in jail during the time that he's testifying to, was he? They were at a club, it seems to me. There are no clubs in jail.
I'm sorry. When Mr. McKelton discussed it with him, he was not in, correct. I was just trying to pick up on the vernacular that was used by the appellant.
Right, and that's what I'm trying to clarify, is that, you know, when I think of a jailhouse informant, I'm usually led to believe that these are two people in a cell talking.
No, and in fact, these discussions were not in jail. These discussions, most of the time, were at Vito's bar. And while these people were on the outside, in between the two murders. So I do apologize.
It's the motivation for their testimony that classifies them as a jailhouse snitch, that they're going to get a quid pro quo for giving the testimony against him that will reflect positively in how the state looks at their case.
Correct. Correct.
But the testimony was, again, outside of jail.
Correct, Chief Justice.
According to Nix's testimony, who were the participants that got into the white van? He said Mick Evans was one, and after that ride, he never came back. Is that right?
Yes.
And who else was in that van with him?
Brian Adams and Lamar Mouse Simmons is a testimony, and I have that written down as transcript page 1805.
And based on that, how do you determine that McKelton was the trigger man in that killing? Or what evidence leads to McKelton as the trigger man as opposed to having someone else kill Mick Creekstout, Mick Evans?
I think the way he described it to Sneed, Lemuel Johnson, and others, that when you look at him saying that he had to kill him, he had to have him killed, but he had to kill him, that's how the testimony played out. And so I think that leads to the potential of him being the trigger man. I think you also have earlier testimony of McKelton in possession of a .40 caliber handgun while at the house. There's a number of things that his use of words in describing to these, pardon the vernacular, jailhouse informants, and then also the previous him being seen with at least arguably a similar weapon to what was used.
Was Evans killed with a .40 caliber weapon?
I believe it was. I believe that's what the shell casings were. It was a Smith & Wesson, I believe 40, is how the testimony came out from a BCI&I expert.
And hence, prosecution theory morphed through the trial to that Kelton did the killing or had it done.
And I think that when you look at the testimony of the informants, and then when you look at Michael Nix, who obviously Michael Nix wasn't there to testify, so it was put on in a different way that did morph it. And I think that's important that Michael Nix did not testify, so his testimony became a little different than maybe what was anticipated, which changed the course of how the case could be argued.
And that's the hearsay that McKelton is objecting to.
Some of that, yes. And Your Honors, I'm eating into Ms. Alcom Howie's time.
I want to ask you a question. Consciousness of guilt, describe that. Why is that such a strong indicator here in supportive of your theory?
Well, I think it's because this court in State v. Taylor said that consciousness of guilt evidence can be evidence of guilt itself. This court has set a very strong level for consciousness of guilt evidence as to what it can mean.
And what was the indication here? What was his evidence of consciousness of guilt?
I think there are numerous things. I think when you look at the run-in with Jermaine's family where he hugs them and apologizes to them, that's consciousness of guilt. I think his communication with Crystal Evans in trying to use a jump-the-five code, in trying to get her as a false alibi. I think trying to have Michael Nix subject to a drive-by shooting is consciousness of guilt evidence. I think in this case there really was a plethora of consciousness.
The drive-by shooting with Mr. Nix is you infer that McKelton ordered that.
Correct.
Right, but there's no direct testimony that occurred.
No direct testimony that he ordered it. No.
How did Nix's
I'm inferring that. I don't think it's.
Are you saying it's so coincidental that Nix's name comes up as a witness and the next thing you know, there's a drive-by shooting attempt to take him out?
Add in the fact that 20 minutes before that, he's asked specifically about appellant's trial, and it's the day after his name comes out.
How did that testimony get into the transcript? Was that Detective?
I believe it was Detective Luke.
Yes. Okay. Thank you.
I believe it's through Detective Luke. Your Honors, one final thing I'd like to say in regards to the forfeiture by wrongdoing, being very brief. What we've said, the domestic violence is not a separate exception to forfeiture by wrongdoing. The Supreme Court in Giles has made that another way to prove the purpose or intent to keep someone. It's not solely separate, but when you have an isolation of a victim that's intended to keep them away from law enforcement, is a separate way to prove the intent that's clear through the majority's opinion and Justice Souter's concurrence. But also, this was not pointed out in our brief, and I wanted to make sure I got to it. The transcript on page 1600, Marcus Sneed talks about the incident where Margaret Allen died. And Marcus Sneed says that appellant tells him they were having a heated argument, and during that Margaret Allen threatened him about the robberies and other murders about which he had confided in Margaret Allen, and then she is killed. So I think that not only does that intent under domestic violence have the separate way to isolate the victim, but even in the first more traditional sense, we do have testimony that satisfies that as well. With that, unfortunately, I would like to reserve more time, but I'll turn the rest of it over to Ms. Alcom Howie. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Counsel? You have less than 7 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor, for that notation. Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. I would like to address preposition of law number 1 and also preposition of law number 15. Thank you. In preposition of law number 1, it's regard the trial court's denial of substitution of counsel and the denial of motion for continuance. The record clearly reflects at arraignment, appointed counsel was present with 2 additional attorneys, specifically indicated that at this point, appellant is indigent and will not be able to proceed with the funding required for a capital case. and appointed counsel indicated he is not specialized in capital cases.
Wait a minute, appointed counsel or hired counsel?
Retained counsel. I apologize, Your Honor. Retained
the
counsel.
The first fellow, Goldberg.
Correct.
Hired by Mr. McKelton. All right.
Retained counsel indicated to the court, I'm not specialized in capital cases. My client at this point is indigent for the requirement of funding for a capital case. The trial court agreed and appointed two counsel, lead counsel Mr. Howard, co-counsel Ms. Cook Howard. They were appointed at arraignment and the entry was filed on March 1st.
Counsel, I want to make sure I'm clear on that. The court then designated lead counsel as an appointed counsel?
Yes, Mr. Greg Howard was designated specifically as lead counsel. That was on page 5-6 at arraignment.
And because Mr. Goldberg was not Rule 20 certified, he was a volunteer here.
A paid volunteer, yes.
Well, not paid going forward. Obviously, whatever he was paid, he didn't feel was sufficient to allow him to continue solely to do this case.
Correct. And Your Honor, the trial court went above what is required in Superintendent's Rule 20. A defendant can retain counsel, and with retainment of counsel, they're not entitled to any appointment. It specifically says the court shall not appoint. The trial court went in opposite to that rule requirement for the additional protection of appellant and appointed on that day two counsel specialized in capital cases. And then what we have is on August 6th at the hearing, so 6 months later, it should be clear that appellant's counsel, lead counsel, Mr. Greg Howard, informed the trial court that his retained counsel has many clients in the Cincinnati area and they're aware that a conflict will come in existence. They were aware back approximately 8 weeks prior to the trial date that a conflict will arise. That is significant time. And even after the conflict, possibility of a conflict arose at the September 1st hearing, still retained counsel decided, I want to wait, I don't want to withdraw yet. It's a delay tactic. They waited until September 17, just prior weeks prior to
counsel,
the trial date.
Counsel, didn't they start running into problems, though, at that point? It seems to me there was a representation being made to the court very close to trial that the experts that you paid to be hired have not been hired. Nobody is doing anything other than an investigator. Didn't the trial court have a duty to inquire further at that point?
The trial court did inquire further prior to the mitigation hearing. At the October 15th hearing, specifically asked counsel, do you wish to proceed? I gave you funding for medical experts, and I gave you funding for, this is pages 6-7.
No, you're at mitigation. I'm not at mitigation. I'm on the eve of trial. Wasn't the trial court informed on the eve of trial that an investigator was working, but the forensic experts that had been funded had not been hired?
Yes, Your Honor, but again, that goes into a strategic decision. The investigator was hired, and based on the invoice, they filed a motion on December 1st, and the invoice indicated he's been on the case since March. He billed them for $8,000, $3,000 more than additional limit. Again, this is a big distinction with the supplemental authority that appellant has submitted, State v. Herring. In that case, the investigator was only filed for $1,500. We have $8,000 in this case. And what we also have in this case, which I really want to focus on the record, is appellant himself at the October 15th on page 6 denied the request, his right to have a pre-sentence investigation report. He denied that request that would go more in depth into his, because there was a theme to the mitigation hearing. The theme was, it's his bad environment, the environment he was raised in. He didn't have a father. His mother was a drug abuser who...
So you don't think that the mitigation expert could have expounded and added layers of maybe authority to substantiate the mere allegations or statements by the defendant and the defendant's family about the conditions of his upbringing. In other words, you know, the mother can testify or someone can testify that she was, you know, a 15-year-old mother, that she was a prostitute and a drug addict. But the consequences of that type of rearing on a child is what is missing as far as a mitigation expert or a, you know, someone that could take those conditions and see how they have actually affected this defendant.
I mean, that missing link is all based on speculation. We are speculating as to what that missing link would have benefited. What we have here is direct evidence of how his childhood was, and it's in correspondence with his unsworn statement. His theme is, I still received my GED. I got busted, his wording was, prior to graduating from high school, and then he received his GED when he was in jail, when he was picked up later, a couple of years later in Cincinnati. Your Honors, I'm out of time, but may I proceed?
You may proceed for another minute.
Thank you, Chief Justice. In his unsworn statement, he indicated he was still productive. He has a child, he has a good relationship with her. Again, we're speculating as to what a mitigation expert would have done more than that. In this case, he had the benefit of the retained counsel for 5.5 months. He had that benefit of this retained counsel who was familiar with his history. He indicated to the trial court, I had represented him in the past. He is my client. I want to assist him in this case, but I'm not qualified. I need the specialized expertise of additional attorney. So again, he had additional protections here, and the investigator went above and beyond. He was on the case since March and continued to conduct based on the invoice.
But counsel, don't you have a problem with your argument there? You're saying the two appointed counsels are Rule 20 certified. These are pros. They know what they're doing, right?
Yes.
And then they come to the court and say, we can't go forward. We're not ready. Are we therefore not to rely on their expertise?
Your Honor, I don't believe the record reflects them saying that. At the September 17th hearing, the continuance request was based on the assumption that their motion to withdraw would be granted and the continuance would provide additional time for new counsel. And right before voir dire, their continuance, again, was based on their request to have additional time.
Well, didn't they directly tell the court, we are not in a position to give effective assistance of counsel in this case today? Didn't they say that to the court?
I don't believe the record reflects that, Your Honor. I believe the record reflects that they wanted that, we're not ready, because they didn't have the names of the witnesses that were not disclosed.
So why did they want to withdraw?
They wanted to withdraw because of according to them, lack of cooperation from appellant.
So they felt their hands were tied. They could not proceed with this trial effectively because their client wasn't?
At the September 17th hearing, they only requested to be withdrawn because the appellant was not cooperating with them. They had a disagreement as to how to strategy for the trial, whether to plea. He disagreed with their insistence of pleading.
Okay, they met with him twice, correct?
Correct.
All right, that alone suggests that there might be a problem. You meet with your death penalty client twice. You don't see a problem with that?
No, Your Honor, because in this case, appellant had an agreement and he was okay with meeting specifically with his retained attorney.
This was after the retained attorney was no longer involved in the case.
No, Your Honor, the record indicates at the September 17 hearing, on page 10 through 13, when appellant directly has a colloquy with the trial court, he says, I have met with Mr. Goldberg many times when he wants to, not when I want to, and I was okay with that agreement with only meeting with appointed counsel twice. He was okay with that arrangement of only meeting with appointed counsel while there were three attorneys on the spot. At that point, he indicated he only met with them twice when he had three attorneys.
Okay, but then he did not have the benefit of Mr. Goldberg at trial, correct?
Yes.
All right. So whatever work Mr. Goldberg had done up to that point, whatever relationship, rapport, his value to the case was non-existent.
The value of the rapport was non-existent, but the value of the work, they were aware 6 weeks, 8 weeks prior to the trial that there's a possibility Mr. Goldberg had a conflict.
A possibility. Okay, when did he actually get off? How far before the trial?
The conflict was confirmed on August 30th. That is 5 weeks prior to the trial.
Okay, during those 5 weeks, defense attorneys did not go and meet with Mr. McKelton.
I'm not aware of when they met. The record only reflects that they met twice prior to September 17th. When those two individual meetings with appointed counsel was, we do not know.
So, counsel, do you have anything in the record that says the trial court asked the attorneys after this motion was made to withdraw? Did the court at any time say, well, counsel, are you ready to proceed, or ask them if they had withdrawn the motion to withdraw? In other words, you know, was the court satisfied that these attorneys were going to do their job for this client?
Yes, Your Honor. At that same hearing on September 17, when the trial court denied their motion, everybody agreed we will proceed. The trial date is set October 4th. And since that time, on October 4th and 5th, when the trial court asked, you ready to go? Yes. And even on October 15th, prior to mitigation, have you discussed everything with your client? Yes. Have you discussed the proceeding without a medical expert? Yes. And that's on page 10 at the October 15th hearing. So yes, there's been multiple meetings since then and during trial.
Wait a minute. There were multiple meetings since
the beginning of trial, based on the record where it says.
Right, once trial started, they're obviously interacting with their client.
Correct.
My time period that I'm concerned with is how they prepped for trial and interacted with their client prior to trial. And that was only two meetings, correct?
As of September 17th, that was two individual meetings, private meetings with appellant. This disregards all the meetings at the hearings. There was
one meeting that was very not private, correct? When they told him in front of a police officer, you better plea?
Yes, for protection, Your Honor. Even the testimony came on the record that for protection, there's always a deputy present during these meetings.
I'm sorry?
The testimony was that the deputy was there for the safety of everyone because this is a capital case charged with aggravated murder. The deputy was present.
So during these two meetings with their client, in at least one of those meetings, a police officer was present?
Correct.
How can you have a meaningful discussion with your client and establish attorney-client privilege and relationship with a deputy standing there?
We're not sure whether the deputy was there the whole time or not, but the record indicates that he was there during their insistence on him pleading guilty.
All right. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, Your Honors.
Counsel, you've saved a minute.
Counsel, before you get into what you want to tell us in response to everything you've heard, I want to go back to where I'm looking at this case, and you heard me raise the issue of residual doubt. If we were to kick this down to life in prison without possibility of parole, based on residual doubt, he's still going to have the opportunity to go to federal court and try to overturn the whole thing, right?
Yes, he would still have an appeal of his convictions, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So we can't even end it that way.
Well, I don't know if we want to end it. I think that this, as this court has pointed out, there was just a complete breakdown, and I believe
well,
that there's
the reason I raise
that
residual doubt is, given his avocation in life of being proudly a bad man and a drug dealer, it's pretty hard to for me to get the mitigation outweighs to independently weigh and say, well, he just on an independent weighing. Mm-hmm. But on residual doubt, with all that happened here, and with the prosecution switching theories as to how this murder even occurred.
Yeah, and I think there's a number of issues that can kind of lead to the same kind of outcome that you're talking about. And I think also if you just look at the lack of advocacy at the mitigation phase, as I talked about before, where a client is telling the jury that psychologists, it's just psychobabble. They tell the jury that we could try to bring in someone to tell you how nice McKelton is, but we all know that's not true. They tell the jury to take the two life with parole eligibility options off the table and go straight to life with without parole. I mean, there's just a complete lack of advocacy that you can view in the mitigation phase that can also lead to that result. I think there's also, like you've talked about, a lack of evidence, a sufficiency of the evidence against the manifest weight of the evidence in this case on some of these charges.
Well, counsel, let me focus you on another, what I find to be one of the most egregious representations here is that the Rule 20 attorneys only met with the client prior to trial two times. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, that is a fair statement based on the motions hearing. And as you stated, at least one of those meetings took place with an officer in the room with them where they're trying to tell them, first of all, a person who they have no relationship, who've not established a rapport with, they don't know what the evidence in the case is because they don't have it disclosed. They can't say, this is why you should take a deal.
Counsel, isn't there also a suggestion in the record that the police officer was there because the appointed counsel had developed a fear of their client?
Well, I believe that the trial court ordered that based on the circumstances of this case, that there was always going to be security present, that there would be no complete private meeting. And so you look at that, and then you also look during the motion to withdraw hearing, and defense counsel says, we believe that they're fitting him with the stun belt because he's been making threats against us. So that was another basis for them wanting to get off the case. They believe that there's maybe potential threats against them.
Well, they don't know that for a fact.
They don't know that for a fact.
But, obviously they wanted off the case. When you're only met your client twice and neither one went particularly well, there might be some motivation there. So,
counsel, can we verify, though, when you say they only met with their client twice before trial?
Mm-hmm.
That's not what I heard. I heard it was only twice before September 17th. Now, from September 17th until the trial started October 4th, you're not saying that the record is clear that they did not meet with him from September 17th to October 4th, are you?
No, there's nothing on the record to indicate one way or another.
I just
about
wanted
the
to clarify that because
okay.
We weren't.
So you're not representing that for those 3 weeks that there was no communication between these the attorneys and your client?
There is nothing on the record to indicate one way or another how many meetings that they were having with him at that point. At all that is on the record is that September 17th, where he's saying the second meeting I'm having with them, they're presenting me with this life without parole. There's been such a breakdown in communications. They're asking to withdraw. He's asking them to withdraw.
Did I understand you correctly that Mr. McKelton threatened the two defense lawyers?
No, I don't believe that there was any threat. I think that they believed that there was a potential threat because of a motion that the state filed saying that they wanted to use a stun belt. And I believe there was some kind of insinuation in that motion that it could have been because of statements he was making about counsel. Now, during
the motion to withdraw, did they put anything in that motion with respect to their client having made threats against them?
During the hearing, Cook brings up that they assume that threats have been made against them because of the stun belt issue. The state tries to assure them, because the state is listening to all of McKelton's calls, no, that's not what we meant. He has not made any direct threats. But, I mean, that and then also the trial attorney, I mean, the trial court's ruling, or perhaps not ruling is not the right word, but him placing the officer in the room with him, they could have been led to believe. I don't believe he actually made any threats, but I could see how counsel could have been led to believe that there were threats.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I guess I'll
we're
just...
finished.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision. Thank you very much.